get settled so that we can start. Thank you very much. This may not necessarily be a graveyard site. We are very energized and thanks for the food that we received. We didn't even pray before we started eating. Those who pray, but we thank the people who prepared the food. We are going to be getting a presentation, honorable members, from DSC attorneys, and Christy Haslam is going to be the presenter. Fortunately, they have been here the whole morning. They have seen how we're doing things. We give you 30 minutes, and we have another 10 minutes on the clock, which we can be able to utilize if we have not been able to finish within the 30 minutes. And then the honorable members will engage one-on-one. They ask you a question, you respond another question, which actually should be able to take us 7 to 10 minutes at most, just like that. So you will be given time. You have seen that already, the two presenters and the two presentations that came before us, we requested them to furnish us with extra information where we believe that we did not get joy in terms of the response to the questions. We requested extra information that should be presented before next week, Thursday probably, and out of that, when we sit as a committee, we will check how we're going to be engaging further with those presentations. On that note, honorable members, I'll request Madam Christie, is it advocate? Attorney Christie Haslam, to introduce her team, and then we get a presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, honourable members, for this opportunity to address you on what I think is personally a very important element of that, and that is the plight of what we consider to be the most vulnerable victims of road accidents, being children. Just to be clear, the aim of this presentation isn't to include aspects relating to loss of support claims. So in other words, this is where a minor child that's under the age of 18 is actually injured in a road accident. Just to refer you to what's now been placed in front of you, this document here, which has compiled a condensed version of the written submissions which we previously sent in, just for ease of reference and particularly for today's presentation. By way of introduction, you'll first be hearing from advocate Mohammed Salih, SC, to my left, an advocate very seasoned in this field who has acted for both the Road Accident Fund as well as plaintiffs, and he's also enjoyed invitations to act as a judge from time to time, and I think his inputs will be valuable for you. And to my further left is Dr. Hanman Eerdelin, neurosurgeon, who will be the first medical professional you've had the opportunity to listen to, which also is quite important, given that the bulk of the presentations you'll be listening to in this round of hearings are from non-medical related organisations. So with that being said, Advocate Salih will now address you.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. And I think our tummies are full, so we got to be alert. Sometimes one day is off after 1 o'clock. I've had sight, Madam Chair, on this particular bill. I've had sight of certain representations made, and of course this morning by my colleague as well from the Cape Bar. What is, to me, mostly the important facet that comes to the fore fall, amongst other issues, is the right of the vulnerable child. And I'm saying this because most of us who are sitting here had grown up in the most, at times, in very commas, unfortunate of circumstances, when we had to go to school in the morning, walk long passages, bare feet, and hope not to be destroyed by a road accident collision. And it gives me some sort of hope in life when recently I appeared in the Constitutional Court. In fact, I acted for RAF in that matter, where I was asked to debate whether foster grants can be deducted from a possible loss of support claim. And a full court of the Cond Court says, and I'm just going to highlight two passages. In terms of Section 281B, every child has a right to family care, parental care, or to appropriate alternative care when removed from the family environment. Section 281C provides that every child has a right to basic nutrition, shelter, basic healthcare services, and social services. Now, Section 281D provides that every child has a right to be protected from maltreatment, neglect, abuse, or degradation. And Section 282 provides that child's best interests are of paramount importance in every matter concerning children and a child. There's another passage which I don't think I want to belabor you too much, but the essence in that judgment was that you can't, and I've quoted Canadian judgments, etc., etc., it was ruled against and the court decided there, you can't deduct that from what the parent would have supported. Section 282, therefore, 28 brackets of the Constitution, is very important, as you've seen, because you haven't added up the document, and against that particular background, it is our submission that the current system, and I'm not going to go through each and every page of our submission, but I want to try to do this verbally. Currently, the system makes provision for a child for general damages, which is in accordance with the constitutional provision of not to be inflicted with violence. And therefore, the RABS, as it is now, does not make provision for general damages. In my submission, that offends the constitutional principle of being free of violence. In the past and currently, we have, of course, the parameter wherein one can work, where a child, for example, and we see it every day on the roads, go past Clifton Road, go past Luguletu, where children actually sell, are employed informally to earn an income. What's happened in terms of RABS? That particular child doesn't have that particular right. He only has the right to claim a long term when he reaches 18. In other words, the particular child has been compromised insofar as general damage is concerned. That particular child is compromised in terms of loss of income is concerned. And of course, what is more pertinent, that particular child, when he or she starts to campus, for example, and he might have been, or many of us sitting here, perhaps the only spark in that home who could have brought hope in that particular child. That particular income, we now know, the last 3 years of income determines the future. Income to be determined actuarially. Assume that child is a medical doctor in the third year, or student, LLB student in the third year, engineering student in the second year. We now know that the current RAB system does not make provision for his or her income to be calculated in terms of an aging year, terms of the doctor's salary, etc., etc., although there's a gap in. So, we submit in brief that the current system as it stands, and it can be tempered with, one can, for example, say, if the issue is about legal cost, remember, the attorneys acting for RAF, and I do a lot of RAF work too, their fees are capped. Counsel's fee is capped. If you want to adjust that in the real system, we want to improve this on the current system, it can be done. But my submission is that the current RAF system, with the greatest of respect, is going to demolish that very poor child who intended to aspire to become great, to become assistant to his extended family, to assist wherever he can. And that particular right of that child is severely compromised. Then, in the past, as I said, and there's some debate where I've read elsewhere that a child who sits behind a steering wheel age 7, etc., etc., causing damages. I don't know how rational that can be argued. We know, and when we act for children, a 1%er is conceded. Invariably, 99% of the cases I've encountered. In fact, the ESCOM case in the SCA makes it quite clear. 13-year-old children are given full damages. There's no abortion out. A learned friend on the right earlier said, what about the right against wrongdoer? If one looks at South Africa currently, we have a massive amount of accidents. Huge amount of accidents. Are we going to take the right, the common right, away from the victim? I don't have the answer. But it seems to me this is exactly what the new bill intends to do. Our submission is, with regard to the children, especially child's right, the current system in terms of past meds is adequately catered for, future meds, there's an undertaking there. It doesn't go and nilly-willy ask for treatment. It must be properly assessed, and that particular undertaking covers the future expenses to be incurred, or actually incurred. We therefore of the view that, and we make the point on pages 9 of our submissions with regard to section 35C, the minor will only qualify for that period only when he reaches the age of 18. We make that submission. Page 10 we make the submission about the point, the 3-year period assessment prior to determining his future loss of income. And of course, the points have been raised this morning with regard to the, once he reaches or she reaches the age of 18, then there's 1-year period to really investigate a claim. With the greatest of respect, we now know in practice that is not the case. To obtain those documentations at times from a flooded hospital, police stations, are very, very difficult. And invariably, to my mind, these cases will become prescribed. Very difficult. Again, the rights of the child. Insofar as future loss of income and capacity is concerned, on page 6 of the document which we handed up, no loss of earning capacity, that is, nowhere to be found in RABS, deemed AANI, annual national income, currently estimated to be 52,000 per annum, 4,377 per month. And then, of course, the government employee as a general worker, starting package is 83,000. 766. Domestic worker annual salary is 45,000 per annum. So, our submissions are very brief. That the rights of children are to be catered in Ramsbull. And they are not. And my difficulty is, as a seasoned campaigner in these particular matters, that one should look perhaps at improving the current system, then, and perhaps even the RADS bill, maybe we should look at that. Let's look at constructively and see to what extent we can maybe borrow from this current act and place into the RADS bill. And that, to my mind, should be perhaps the starting point. And just on page 3 of our document which you handed up, we've looked at just our 1,000 most recent loss of earning calculations. 33% were actually males under the 20 years of age. 25% were females under 20 years of age. Again, the point we make and submission we make is, it is the youth, it is the youngsters, those who want to carve out a life, a profession, under difficult circumstances, who will be compromised. These are my submissions. I know I've been told I must be brief. I do not want to... The submission with regard to the common law right, we are of the view you should give consideration that it be not abolished. Our submission is that, let's take an example. One comes from a soccer match, and there's siblings walking together. Here comes a person who's heavily intoxicated, wipe out a family. He tells you, wipes out this family. Everybody's there, brain damage, head injuries, and we know at times how difficult it is to diagnose a minor head injury, and it's so diagnosed, they actually fall out. Dr. Ehrlich can expand on that. We don't know that these people, A, would not be able to claim for general damages. Where is that child's right to claim against the wrongdoer, the common law right? It's been taken away. Severely curtailed. It's heartbreaking to see when we are, and many, and the speaker himself, coming from difficult background. I've been reminded I've got 2 minutes. From difficult backgrounds, who wants to aspire to have an education, to improve his or her life, whose life has been compromised, general damage has been taken away, his loss of income that he or she, in fact, assisted by providing a parent at the age of 14, 15, in the alternative, has been taken away. He's only having, he can only qualify for the age of 18, and that's also under strained and strenuous circumstances. I'll repeat earlier, if he's a second year, third year student, he's got to look at, he's got no income, he's got no yardstick, he's got no barometer to check out what his income would have been to qualify for the future loss of income. That's also been taken away. So my submission is, let's pool our resources together, and I'm prepared to sit on any committee for that matter, if I'm invited, if it's after hours. In fact, today I sacrificed a brief to a BNI court for a student, and my attorney, my right hand said, please, Bob, but just make your contribution because of experience. And this is a challenging experience. Our kids need to be catered for. These are my submissions. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, honourable members, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. And I wish to particularly thank honourable Mponza for assisting me to find the council chamber this morning. My name is Herman Edelin. I'm a neurosurgeon in private practice in Johannesburg. I have, over the past 18 years more or less, I've done in-depth assessments of about 3,500 people who've been involved in motor accidents. Almost all of them have been people who have suffered head and brain injuries. I think it's necessary, Madam Chair, to just give more or less the demographic of the people that I have seen in my practice. Approximately a quarter of them are in a sustainable and, in my concept, adequate employment. And by adequate employment, I don't mean wealthy people. I mean people who are teachers, policemen, clerks, civil servants, but they are people who have a house, a motor car and a medical aid fund. And my particular interest in what I have to say today is in relation to those who have a medical aid fund. The other three quarters of those 3,500 people are poor. Some of them are in some form of employment, but it is menial employment at very low wages, or it's piece jobs, and many of them are unemployed. Now, all of those, that 75%, were vulnerable before they had their head injury. After their head injury, they become that much more vulnerable. And I know I'm talking in a children's slot, but I'm not limiting my remarks to children, but I am limiting my remarks to the plight of vulnerable people. Vulnerable by way of poverty, of illiteracy, unemployment, and particularly by head injuries. Now, looking at the RAPS bill as published in 2017, I wish to limit my comments to Chapter 7, which is about the claims procedure, and then I wish to talk about the medical treatment, because everything I say about the claims procedure is going to be relevant to what I say about access to healthcare services. I'm not here to talk about compensation in any sense, and I'm not here to talk about any legal aspects of this. I'm here about the medical care of vulnerable people. So turning to Chapter 7, the claims procedure. I don't have enough time to explain in detail, and I would be very willing to engage with the committee in any detail that is necessary as to why and exactly. But in the short time available, Section 42 that deals with the procedure for claiming benefits. The patients who I know, and I'm not speculating about a straw man or somebody who I imagine. I'm talking about those who I have assessed. Each one of them, Madam Chair, I have done detailed, in-depth, long assessments of their circumstances, their injuries, their outcome, and the change in circumstances before and after the accident. This is not counting the thousands of others who I have seen in my capacity as chairman of an appeals tribunal for the Road Accident Fund in the HPCSA, where we deal with exactly the same thing. In what way have people's circumstances changed as a result of their injuries? Now, the patients that I know well, because I've done in-depth assessments personally, the vast majority of them do not have the capacity to comply with the procedure for claiming benefits. And the simple effect of that is if they do not have some form of competent administrative assistance, they will not claim. If we look at 63, obligations of the claimant and beneficiary, they do not have the capacity to comply with those obligations. So, if in some way they manage to submit a claim, they found the right place and they filled in the right form, and then there are certain obligations are placed on them, they will not understand or not be able to write, and they will not know how to deal with that. Section 44, information to be furnished to the administrator by third parties. My patients do not know that information themselves. They do not have the capacity to provide the administrator with that information. Section 46 claims lapses in certain circumstances. They will not know when a time period has gone by. They will not know in how many days they have to do something to remedy the problem. My lady, I beg your pardon, Madam Chair, all of these provisions for the submission of claims will effectively exclude persons with head injuries, illiterate people, and many people who are unemployed. It will specifically target poor and vulnerable people. And people with head injuries who were not poor before the head injury become poor after the head injury. So if it is the purpose of this bill to assist people who are poor or vulnerable, I think it is very important for the legislators to understand there's a large group of victims of road accidents who will be specifically targeted and they will be harmed even further. If I can turn to the aspects of access to health care, they are in Chapter 6, categories of benefits. Part A of Chapter 6 relates to healthcare services. The person with a brain injury doesn't know how to find somebody who can understand his brain injury. And when the person with a brain injury goes to what they are aware of, and in the public health service, that is local clinics, regional hospitals, central hospitals, they go to hospitals. But who they see at that hospital is a medical officer or a nurse. I cannot tell you how many people with severe brain injuries I've seen who have spent years with untreated epilepsy because they go to the clinic and they go to the hospital and the person who sees them doesn't understand what it is. The patient with the epilepsy doesn't know how to explain that I'm suffering from epileptic seizures. They talk in their language. And when I say language, I'm not talking about Sotho or English. I'm talking about the way that they can explain medical concepts. When I ask people who have epilepsy, do you have epilepsy? They say no, because they don't know what epilepsy means. So I have to ask them, do you have fits? Some of them will understand what I mean by fits, and they will respond. Others will say, what is that? I have to show them, do you know about that condition where people start to shake and they bite their tongue and fall on the ground? Oh, yes, yes, they know about that. Do you have that condition? Yes, I do. But it takes a neuroscience, either a neurologist or a neurosurgeon or somebody who understands brain disease to know how to ask the questions, particularly of a person who is illiterate, so that you can find out what their condition is and what treatment they need. People who go to hospitals because they have behavioral disorders, mood disorders, mental impairment, they are unable to work, they have difficulty thinking. They don't know how to go to the clinic or the doctor or the hospital and say, oh, I've got a mental disorder because I can't think properly. They don't say that. They don't think of it. It is their very capacity to think which is hampered. They will say, oh, I've got a headache. So there are many people who come for countless reasons complaining of headache. And the clinics and the doctors and the casualties or the outpatient departments, for headache they give a packet of Panado and they say go home. They don't know that I must refer this person to the neurology department or I must refer this person to a neuropsychologist. Many, many, many people that come to my attention have been untreated because the places they've gone for help did not understand what they were complaining of. Not because of a failure of doctors and nurses to be properly trained, but because of the lack of capacity of a brain injured person to explain that I have got brain damage. And when they explain what they understand, which is I'm tired, or I'm
I don't sleep nicely, or I fall, or I've got headaches. Whatever they can understand to complain is interpreted in a different way. So, Madam Chair, the simple fact is that without a rational and an equitable provision in the Act, those people will be excluded from access to healthcare services. And I'm talking about the ones who do somehow manage to lodge a claim. As I've already said, the majority of them will not even pass that hurdle. There is another concern that I have, and I don't have much time, but in this bill, there's a provision that the administrator will set a tariff of fees for medical and hospital treatment. But that was said already in 2014. The South African Medical Legal Society did make formal submissions to the Department of Transport, many submissions in 2014. I was very disheartened to find in the republished bill in 2017 that not one of those considerations were taken at all into account. It's all the same. And that even now, the proposed tariff that was foreshadowed at that stage does not appear here. And this reminds me of the Road Accident Fund Amendment Act from 2008 to 2010, which went to the Constitutional Court in 2010. Now, on that occasion, Madam Chair, the Minister of Transport sought to remunerate medical services for road accident victims in terms of emergency services at the so-called NHRPL rate and for long-term services at the so-called UPFS rate. Of that challenge that the Law Society took to the Constitutional Court, it was only my submissions at that stage in relation to the unfairness of those tariffs that was upheld by the Constitutional Court. Now, the Road Accident Fund and the Department of Transport should have learned and understood from the Constitutional Court that if you wish to provide people, especially vulnerable people, with access to healthcare treatment, you must provide real access, not a notional tariff that will get them no access. So I very much hope that when these tariffs are devised or published, that they take reality into account and not some money-saving notion which will effectively result in no treatment. Thank you.
Your turn, ma'am.
Madam Chair, thank you. With your leave, we'd like to take the opportunity of that extra 10 minutes just to conclude on our submissions at this point. Just to come back to something that Advocate Sali alluded to earlier, I want to expressly debunk the myth of fault as surrounds the rights of children under the RAF Act. In terms of the various assumptions, and the Department alluded to them yesterday in a different context, a child under the age of 7 has to establish a notional 1% guilt on the part, not guilt, pardon me, negligence on the part of the offending driver. It is the most rare of circumstances that you will not establish that negligence. Children are injured either as pedestrians or as passengers in vehicles, not drivers of vehicles typically. So when it comes to the carrot of no fault under RAFs, it's actually not much of a carrot vis-a-vis the rights of a child when you compare it to what they are losing or will lose under RAFs. By way of illustration, I did an internal review of our practice in preparation for today. Of the 25 children's claims which we finalised in the past 12 months, 24 of them resulted in a 100% liability on the part of the fund. There was a singular instance of an apportionment, which was 90%. And on balance, it cannot be argued that looking at the benefits under RAF, that they will be better off, and I'll address that further shortly. Also, when it comes to no fault, which hasn't been addressed yet, is who actually benefits from the no fault system at the end of the day? And I want to relate that to our deplorable accident statistics, which is amongst the worst in the world. where it's estimated that as many as 65% of our accidents are as a result of drunk and reckless and negligent driving. Now, reckless and negligent driving is something more than the moment's inattention, which was oft quoted in the Constitutional Court case relating to the Amendment Act. We're talking drunk drivers and extremely reckless and negligent drivers who are going to be advantaged in the no-fault system over and above the interests of the most innocent of victims, which is the child, who didn't place themselves in that situation. And I think that's something we have to really consider when we want to look at equity and reasonableness under the proposed system. Tying into what Dr. Edelin referenced with regard to head injury, in my experience in dealing with children's matters, and it is a particular area of interest of mine, where a child has suffered long-term consequences, I'm talking over and above a serious injury which would qualify them for an award of general damages, I'm talking about where they've suffered a demonstrable loss of earning capacity. In my experience, that's principally been relating to head injury. Head injury in children can often be looked over or misinterpreted by the layperson, and in that context I mean the lay parent. It takes specific questioning, as Dr. Edelin mentioned, to illustrate specific aspects that might arise as a result of head injury. A child that's had a head injury, 6 years old, who suddenly starts acting up and misbehaving at school, the parents and teachers and family might attribute that to mere naughtiness in youth, whereas it can actually be a powerful indicator of long-term consequences of head injury. So the aspect of head injury is important because I anticipate that under RAD it will go missed in a large majority of cases. I want to come back to Section 28.2 also of the Constitution, which is known as the Bill of Rights, and just emphasise again that that stipulates that the interests of the child are of paramount importance. It cannot be suggested that the interest of indemnifying a drunk or reckless driver can possibly trump the right of an injured child. Just in conclusion, and because I'm a litigator who believes in demonstrable evidence, you've heard a lot about based on charts and tables and theoretical examples, and I thought it might be illustrative to the committee, Madam Chair, to refer you to a concrete example where I can illustrate the total inequity of RAB vis-a-vis children versus RAB. And with Advocate Sali's assistance, he's just going to distribute a picture to all of you. And in advance, I apologise if you find the picture distressing. You may not be accustomed to dealing with these kind of images, but I think it's a very powerful image which hopefully will resonate with you. I'm introducing you here to Ms. Nankamso, and I haven't identified her surname, obviously. And what we have here is a 16-year-old young girl of the Eastern Cape, resident of Willowvale, who was injured as a passenger in a motor vehicle collision. She simply woke up after the collision and was under the vehicle in unbearable pain, burn injuries and related injuries. What we have illustrated in front of us here is a massive, what's referred to as a degloving injury. There were orthopedic injuries as well, but you can clearly see the extent of this injury. This young girl had an ambition to become a teacher, which she tried to pursue after she'd missed 2 years of school because of the collision, and having ultimately matriculated against odds. She tried to pursue a career as a teacher. She qualified but could not fulfill the functional requirements of the position. She did retain a residual earning capacity less than that of a teacher. Under RAF, Nankamso was awarded her medical expenses, both past and future. An injury of this nature, by the way, cannot be remedied much further than this because of the extent of the injury. So this is what she is left with for life. she was awarded her loss of earnings, both in the past as well as in the future, and that related to her loss of earning capacity because she couldn't fulfill her dream of teaching and had to resort to a lesser position. Under RAB, Nankamsu would walk away with her medical expenses only. General damages is abolished. There's no scope for loss of earning capacity. And if you look at the AANI, which would apply of 52,000 as currently estimated per annum, her residual earning capacity exceeded that. And as we know, the bill provides for the deduction of post-accident earning capacity whilst not fairly comparing it with pre-accident earning capacity. So there's a complete imbalance in that assessment. So just to come back to that, Nankamsu would be left with her medical expenses only. And as a mother first and foremost, and secondly, secondarily as an attorney practicing in this field, I struggle to find any argument whereby it can be maintained that that situation and that treatment of this claimant, this minor, can possibly be argued to be equitable or reasonable. Mm-hmm. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, here we go. Are there takers on this matter? Honourable Mzinga, Honourable Mpanza, Honourable Ramatakana, Honourable Sithole, Honourable Khade. Honourable Mzinga.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for the three presenters. If I could start off with Advocate Sali. You paid particular attention to the most vulnerable group, children, and thank you for highlighting that specific category of road accident victims. But I would like to just, as you also declared yourself as a seasoned campaigner, ask from your experience then, what role would you say or judge general damages as a component, as a mechanism? If I could rephrase, common law right? How would common law right act as a mechanism in terms of general road behavior? Then we had a workshop yesterday. Okay. And at the workshop, it was presented that RABS would give us a 20% saving. Out of your experience and as a seasoned campaigner, having to deal on both sides in terms of legal representation for RAF and also for victims, do you think in the administrative functioning of the current road accident fund, a 20% saving is achievable, or even a bigger saving? And what could be done? What could be done differently? And are there things that we should follow up with you in terms of recommendations? Is there a resource outside available of knowledge and experience that could benefit and add value to the question that the road accident fund should be prioritized and fixed, rather than presenting the road accident benefit scheme as the only solution? Then a question to Dr. Herman Edling, also relating to solutions. I was a bit upset by your remark that presentations were made over the years in previous opportunities of submission in this RABS bill that's been evolving since shortly after Satchel finished, which was closer to 2000 than to where we are now. That there were opportunities for submissions, but did I understand you correctly that very little, to your judgment, was absorbed of the recommendations and presentations that that were presented over the years, and whether there are any particular solution-focused options that you would want to present to this committee and to the department. And lastly then to Kirsty, the loss of earnings capacity, which you presented with with an example at the end, in relation to other differences apart from the loss of earnings capacity, maybe the general damages, maybe common law right, what other aspects are there that you see as major differences between the scenarios that we currently have and considering for the future? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. Comrade Chair, with regard to the first question about the general damages component, it is well-established law that a general damages component consists of pain, shock, suffering, endless, and act of seeing when I act for government, hospitals where children lie cold for the rest of their lives on stretchers arising from malpractice in hospitals. And at times, in addition to the award of general damages, especially for those children who come from disadvantaged background and parents who also come from disadvantaged background, where you really can't escalate the child into what profession he or she would become, the courts have often, and when I act for the victims at times, and there's no specific evidence to convince a court to award damages based on an actuarial basis, then, and this is the question that you probably want to have answered, then the courts, in addition to general damages, add to that loss of earning capacity. And that is still the common law.
That's your first question, response. I hope you satisfied with that question and the response.
The second one, regarding your workshop, unfortunately I wasn't present, but the gist of what I put in is whether RABS, if it comes in, would amount to a 20% saving. Is that, is my understanding correct?
If I could just help there, Chair.
Continue.
It was alluded yesterday that with some other calculation, there would be a 20% saving with RABS.
Yes.
I'm asking you, having the experience of Road Accident Fund, RAF, out of your experience, are there savings to be made that could even maybe exceed the saving of what was mentioned?
In short, I believe there can be massive savings if, for example, I'm just giving certain parameters what one could follow. Instead of appointing different experts, the plaintiff and the defendant can have a joint expert, and that happens elsewhere, overseas as well. So, for example, the Indian subcontinent, where I've been and I've done some studies there, the parties in the pre-trial is being asked to have one expert. You join, you stand or form an expert. Instead of having triple, four, quadruple experts, massive savings can be avoided. You can say, Dr. Yidlin, for example, can be appointed to act for the plaintiff and for the defendant to determine the extent, the nature and extent and the fallout of a minor head injury. Instead of going to another expert, another neurologist, another neuropsychologist, massive experts that you employ. So yes, there's definitely room for improvement. And instead of getting RABS involved, explore the possibility and or actually the probability that assume expert, you appoint one common expert, I believe there can be massive savings. That's just one issue. Similarly, in merit matters, for example, if there's one expert appointed instead of two, if you need an expert, of course, because in my experience, as I alluded earlier, the minors, young children, when I act for RAF, are easily conceded, because they only need 1%. Even if it's 13-year-old, the test is that child, he or she, matured enough to appreciate the wrongfulness of his or her action, and 1% is conceded. The problem is that when council, and without a fear of contradiction, when I make recommendations to RAF and or to my instructing attorney, they are not followed. If I say, gentlemen and ladies, we've looked at the pre-morbid, we've looked at the post-morbid, this is an X amount. This is not what they will want to give. They give you 50% less. What the plaintiff's attorney does, prevent from being sued for unsettlement, the matter goes to court. And then what often happens, they actually beat the tenant. Because our presiding officers are experienced in these matters. And sometimes you're tongue in cheek. So you run an unnecessary legal cost for 5 days, whereas if counsel's advice had been heeded to, that matter would be settled on Thursday. That's the second issue. There are many other examples I can give, but it's just the two, three. Yes. What can be done to prioritize the current system? Much can be done, I think. Educate the current staff component. Interact between attorneys and counsel and staff members. And educate them more on how to quantify, look at the pre-morbid. Sometimes one must have a robust approach. And this has happened many times, and much legal cost has been saved. I believe it can be prioritized. And if all of this put their heads together, I think the current system. In fact, I just had a recent matter where a foreign, and somebody has mentioned earlier about $2 billion, where the road accident fund cap applies, and we don't pay them in dollars, we pay them in terms of our cap. This is our current, I think, it's a beautiful system, we're saving lots of money. There's a German claimant where I'm acting for the Rosa Accident Fund, in addition to the apportionment, because there's wrongdoers fault, and this is what I'm saying, why do we abolish this? We've got a 30% apportionment there, and we have the cap. Although in terms of civil judgment, there are priorities in terms of deductions. So I think we've got a lovely system at the moment. It's just a matter of panel meeting it. We can, as I said, I'm not openly shut about it. We can perhaps merge the two and debate and see to what extent one can come to a practical solution who will alleviate alleviate the plight of the poor. Thank you. I hope that answers your question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for the questions.
Just before, probably even you, Doctor, will be able to respond to the question. If you are indicating that you can be able to appoint centrally all the experts, can you be able to link the experts legally and medically into one kitty? And who should be able to do that? Will it be the administrator of RAPS, or how should it be able to function? Because if you recall earlier on, there was somebody who's saying when you get appointed by the administrator, you become kind of subjective because he must grease your hand and wash your hand, so you will not be able to do a thorough work. So if you can be able to respond to that, probably even the doctor can be able to chip in.
I can respond to that as well, Madam Chair. Before answering the specific questions posed to me, Honourable Hunsinger, I want to very strongly support what Advocate Sali said now. There are many attorneys and many experts who hate me because I've been well known for years advocating for single expert appointments and also advocating for mediation as opposed to litigation for resolving disputes of a medical nature, both in medical negligence and in personal injury matters. Both of those are very powerful mechanisms that can result in major cost savings. To come to Madam Chair's question, it cannot work for anybody to have the authority to decide, and that is a final decision, who will be the expert or who will make whatever decisions. Because people are corruptible and people abuse authority. What we have done a lot of work developing the concept of medical mediation. And I have, together with Judge Clarkson, mediated very successfully a number of medical matters. And we have addressed these issues successfully. The first thing is that we recommend, it's not essential, but we recommend that each party has legal representation. Because often the parties do not have the capacity to state their case properly or to understand whether it is in their interest to accept a settlement or not. So we strongly recommend legal representation. We do recommend a single expert, but nobody has the authority to decide. The appointment of a single expert must be done by agreement between the opposing parties. And when the opposing parties agree on any expert, and it doesn't matter how clever or stupid or left or right that expert is considered to be, when an expert is appointed from a position of trust by two opposing parties saying, "Doctor, we trust you. We want you to give us your real opinion to assist justice and to assist the process." Immediately that takes away from the doctor this thing of, "I must try and help this team or I must try and help that team." And that which is an inherent consequence of the adversarial litigation system that we have, is the main reason for experts to differ. Because experts believe, and it's not a properly motivated belief, but they do believe that. You see, Madam Chair, doctors are different to lawyers. They are helping professions. They're different to politicians also. And I'm not saying politicians or lawyers are bad. They have a different role in society. But a doctor...
You have just explained what the doctors are helping professions. I thought you'd go into the lawyers, what the lawyers are, and what the politicians are.
My lady, certainly. I'm not an expert on lawyers or politicians, but I'm happy to say how I see them. Lawyers are there to assist members of the public to resolve disputes. And they need to use their legal knowledge, which is essential for that. Politicians are there to make laws for the country and to see to proper administration of the country. That is their legitimate role. The legitimate role of doctors is to help people. When a patient comes into a doctor's office, the doctor asks, "What's wrong? What can I do to help?" Now, because of that, because of having the helping hat in their heart, when a lawyer comes and says, "Gee, doc, you know, this poor person has got been terribly compromised, terribly injured, and that miserable insurance company only wants to undercompensate him. We've been told you are so clever. You can help us to achieve justice. You can explain to the court why this claim is worth $5 million and not only $1 million like the other side thinks." What does the doctor's heart want to do before he thinks? Subconsciously, he wants to help because he's been complimented. And he's been asked to help, so he wants to help the person who is before him. In litigation, to help this person, you have to be against that person. Now, we spend a tremendous amount of time, and I'm currently the course leader of the first certificate course in South Africa in medico-legal practice, where we teach the law applicable to medical practice, to medico-legal practice, the medical sciences, and also the ethics and the psychology. And we teach that your function is not to help the person who came to you. and is not to attack that person's enemy or opponent. Your function is to serve the interests of justice and to assist the court to make a fair determination. And your function in that regard only extends to your medical expertise. You cannot decide for the court what the court should do. That is what we teach, my lady. But it is difficult for doctors to get that. And when a doctor is appointed jointly by two opposing sides on a basis of trust, the whole problem goes away. Now, we do say that if the opposing parties are unable to agree on a joint appointment, although that is recommended, then obviously they would have the right to appoint their own independent experts or their own opposing experts. But the encouragement has been single experts, and in all the cases that I've mediated, the mediations have been handled successfully on the basis of a single expert in each relevant discipline. Because the parties have also accepted this doctor, what he says makes talk sense. So I strongly support that, as well as mediation as a cost-saving measure. Honourable Hunsinger, our submissions in 2014 did not come, as far as I know, to the portfolio committee. There were no verbal submissions. We did, in terms of the public invitation, we submitted written submissions to the Department of Transport. Who received those? Who read them? Who absorbed them? I really don't know. We've had no feedback. But all I do know is that the content of our written submissions in 2014 are not reflected in any way in the 2017 revised bill. Then, to answer your further question, Honourable Hunsinger, in 2015, after having objected to the RABS bill, we anticipated that the day would come when the legislator would decide that because RABS is bad, it would need a better alternative. And because we had a lot of experience and understanding of what was wrong with RABS, and also, by the way, what is wrong with the current RAF Amendment Act, we started working on that. And I was chairperson of a medical committee who worked for exactly that purpose, to draw up a proposal to be incorporated in a future better road accident fund legislation. The report was written in March 2016, and that report has been held in abeyance in anticipation of the day that we would be asked. And my heart is so happy today, because this is the day. Today, before my presentation, other members of this committee have appropriately asked other presenters, please give us advice. Please tell us what you think we should do. Now, Madam Chair, what I, and again only in a medical context, not talking about money or law or anything, simply in terms of the medical treatment and the medical assessment of road accident victims, we have drawn up a comprehensive system, and it is sensible, it is cheap, and it is easy. It avoids conflict, and its ultimate end point, we've also heard about international, what other countries do. At the time of doing that work, we looked at what they do in the United States, and in Australia, and in the United Kingdom. We found a marvelous system that exists currently in the United Kingdom, a publication which is designed for the determination of general damages for injuries. Now, the beautiful thing about that is that this publication is written by judges for judges, and it is in its 13th, or maybe by now in its 15th revision. It sets out, if you forget about the money terms or the fact that it's for general damages, it sets out in a very rational and sensible manner a way that a lawyer can understand how bad this person's injury is. So it deals not with the injury at the time, like fracture femur or broken ankle or brain injury. It deals with the permanent disability, the consequences of the injuries, because that is what people live with, that is what makes people unable to work, and that's what makes people require compensation, is the permanent disability. That book
has got very sensible ways of classifying outcome of injuries. And what we have done is we've studied that book and found that it is the best that we can find in the world. And there is a professor of law who is at the moment busy working on the process of converting those pound awards per category in that book to South African value. Now, what he's doing is not simply doing a rand-pound conversion factor, because he's taking into account South African circumstances and South African laws and case law in South Africa. But even if it's not used for calculating awards for general damages, the endpoint of the procedure that we have described ends up with a person's long-term disability being classified in terms of that very sensible. Now, I would be very happy for the opportunity to go in detail into those proposals with the committee if the committee is interested in that. Thank you, Madam.
If you can also assist the committee and indicate the name of the journal, then the committee can be able to go online and just go through some of the aspects of that journal.
I have the report here.
Okay.
Okay.
The report we can give to Valerie. Okay. No, thank you very much. Who was next? Honourable Mpanza. Honourable.
Madam Chair, I think there was finally a question posed to myself, which I must confess I've lost track of. I was so caught up in the orations of my colleagues. If I can just be clear, in terms of what you were asking me to address, Honourable Member, do I understand correctly it relates to the difference between RAF and RAD as relating to general damages and the abolition of the common law right, which has a profound impact, particularly, again, limiting myself to the context of children's claims. I think sometimes we're a bit dismissive about this claim for general damages. I think to non-lawyers, it's a very airy-fairy concept, what is general damages. And it's actually supposed to be somewhat of a sort of solatium, a peace offering for the injured, just as an acknowledgement of the pain, the disfigurement, the loss of amenities of life that your injury has had on you. And this is particularly pertinent in the case of children. I think without question we can accept that children experience trauma on a far higher level than adults. There's that lack of understanding, they can't rationalise what has happened, feeling alone, having to spend time in rehab facilities because parents are working, and that whole scenario, if I can put it that way. In that context, the abolition of general damages under RAB can't be supported and is hugely prejudicial to the child. An award of general damages is often used to improve the quality of life of the injured victim, where income replacement benefits, obviously under RAB, these come at a later stage and there's nothing available to address those needs. In terms of the abolition of the common law right, the remarks made by Advocate Van Heerden earlier this morning are apposite, and I'm in agreement with that. There can be no justification, specifically within the very limited constraints of RAB. There can be no justification for the abolition of the common law right. One can at least give the injured child the prospect of recovering a portion at least of their actual losses, because under RAB, there's no question, actual losses are ignored. Does that answer your question, Honourable?
Honourable Pan.
Thank you, Chair, and greetings to the team, ma'am, and the doctor and the advocate. Chair, I think this the presentation today is very exciting and very also helpful, because all the presenters, they've got areas where they are emphasis, and it makes it a little bit easy for us to understand, rather than the general presentation, and I think it's helping us very much, that one. I really appreciate it. The emphasis on the rights of the child, which you are recommending that they should be included in the rights. And I think we need to get motivation. You have motivated, and then discuss those issues. But also, I think it is important that we just establish. I think my colleague, because sometimes I struggle to pronounce his surname, due respect, I just imagine his name, the Honorable Len. and he's very happy with that. Yes. Just to establish something. He started that process because it will help us when going forward, when we know which are the areas that we agree on and areas that we don't agree. For an example, in the initial presentation, he asked whether do we all agree with the no-fault approach. Are we agreeing, saying, because the previous presenters, they said, no, then we don't have a problem. But they are identifying other areas that need to be improved in the red. So I want to establish from you. You want us to do away with the no approach a component, or you say, okay, it's fine, we can remain, because I had a different sentiment in your presentation when it comes to that issue. It's one issue that is keep on coming all the time, no fault approach. And the other issue, I think, Chair, I don't hear everyone saying that don't amend RAF. I don't hear anyone saying that. Completely opposed to the amendment of RAF. Into RAFs, but you are all identifying shortcomings in the proposed amendments. So you're saying the system needs to be improved. So I think that will help us. Rather than maybe you hear the emphasis and say, no, the status quo remain, improve RAF, and let's remain with RAF. So I think it will help us so that we know where we are going. Chair, on the issue of the emphasis on the child's rights, there was an issue also of that RAF does not make provision for the general damages which preside of depriving the child certain rights, but also it might be unconstitutional. I just want to get that one also, because when we deal with this thing, we should focus on all aspects, financial, the rights, and also the constitution itself. Because as my colleague was saying, we want to make a good law, the law that is not going against the constitution, and actually it violates the very same supreme constitution. Dr. Edwin, I like your emphasis also on the poor and the vulnerable. And I think that has been the running theme also, that we all talk about that. And also, you talk about access to health service, which I think is important. And you say we should not have a tariff, emphasize on the tariff, but that does not give access, you know, to health services, but the emphasis is that there must be, those people must have access to health services. But you will respond and elaborate further on that one. Chair, when we discussed also the issue during the other previous presentations, there was this issue that I think it was raised by Webb, one of our honorable members, that people now are able to claim direct without using the lawyers as a middle people. and they can claim and using the service providers, the health service providers. But there was an issue that there's no body that is regulating that service providers organization or the group. So you might also have some loopholes there. Now I want the doctor to, because that is talking to your fraternal group, medical health service providers. What is your view on this one? Where people can just claim the victims direct held by the RAF or the and then not using the lawyers, but working with the health service providers. Are you happy with that, or you still feel that there must be something that is done also on this one? Lastly, Chair, is the issue of yesterday we were told that RAF, there were campaigns in education programs that educate people, because it became clear that most of the vulnerable and poor people, they don't know about their rights and even about the medical scheme and the fund and all those things. And we were assured that no, in terms of the RAF, they have started a very big campaign of making people to know that there are facilities, where they can go to and all those things. Do you think that in the RAFs there are provisions that are put in place to actually make sure? Because what's the point of having an act or a bill when the very same people who should be beneficiaries of that, they don't know? It becomes a very self-defeating exercise. Now I'm raising this because Dr. Yu said that people, you know, because of ignorance, maybe I'm one of those, I come to the doctor and say I've got a headache, and maybe I don't have a headache, but because people are not educated, and we're a society where people, particularly those who were not privileged to get knowledge about things, and they are in the majority most of the time, and they become the very same victims. And we who are fortunate, we must put a mechanism in place to make sure that people are educated and knowledgeable about particular issues. So that awareness programs and education to me are very much important, because if people are ignorant and people are not empowered, then they become victims and they don't access what belongs to them. And I think it's something that we can do. Lastly, Chair, if I will also be happy if the presenters can, in point four, just put their proposals and submit it to you by Thursday, as we have asked others to put some suggestions, so that when next time we engage with them, then we'll then focus ourselves on the recommendations and the way forward, and try to find each other as to how we then can improve this process. Thanks very much, everybody.
Thank you very much. You can respond.
Thanks, Madam Chair. There was quite a series of questions there. If I might suggest, I'll deal with the first couple. The issue of constitutionality, I'll defer to Advocate Sali, and then there were a couple of pointed questions specifically to Dr. Eerdling. Starting at the beginning, in terms of the question as to whether we agree with the no-fault system proposed, I'm afraid I'd have to give a typically lawyerly answer and say yes, but. And my concerns are what is being sacrificed in the interest of being seduced by no-fault as a system. Coupled with, I have very real concerns, and I don't want to encroach here on the terrain of the actuaries. You're going to get very detailed submissions from them at a later point in time. I'm very concerned about the affordability and sustainability of a no-fault system within our context. If we look at the systems where no-fault has been implemented and which was relied on heavily in the Satchwell report, you would see that those are typically first world countries and their accident rates are up to 20% of ours. So in other words, we have 80% more accidents and we don't have the economic infrastructure that they have. And even in those systems, since the Satchwell report was published, some of those countries have indeed gone back to a fault-based system because they couldn't make it work. So yes, in principle, no fault is attractive, but I've got grave concerns as to how practicable it is within our context. In terms of choosing RAP versus RAD, I think that there is room for a compromise between the two, and coming back to the somewhat cliched title to our presentation today, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, particularly pertinent in drought-ridden Western Cape. But I think that there are elements of RAB that are workable, and certainly within the framework of RAB, I think that there's room for a compromise. I'm not doggedly maintaining that RAB is perfect. I don't think any of the people making submissions are doing so. It is flawed, but it's not a horse with a lame leg ready to be shot, if I can put it that way. So I think there's room for a compromise. I think as a consoling will then address the constitutionality issue.
Comrade Chair and Comrade Pouncey, if one looks at the constitutional provision, more particularly Section 12, I think, if I just want to get it. Yes, it's 12. It says that, and that provision consists as follows: freedom and security of persons. And that subparagraph 1, everyone has a right to freedom and security of person, which includes the right, and he's got a, she's got a vested right, A, not to be deprived of freedom arbitrarily or without just cause. Now we know once a child is paralyzed, head injured, severely head injured, and pays under curatorship, his or her right to freedom is deprived because he or she can't do anything. Second issue is not to be detained or thrown less on us. Now, this is important. C, to be free from all forms of violence from either public or private sources. Now, a person who drives the car, children emerging from a stadium, just having watched a joyful day of afternoon soccer and been smashed over by a person who's had no regard to the rights of a child, well, that particular provision immediately kicks in because that child is being inflicted with violence. Hence, it makes serious inroads to the right of a child to be free from violence. And therefore, the right to general damages, as this Hassan points out, solatium, pain, shock, suffering, and inclusive therein, is perhaps the right of the earning capacity he or she possessed has been eroded. I'm not sure the Constitutional Court may differ, or there may be a split decision, but I am convinced that one can put up a cogent argument that the provision that general damages is being taken away is unconstitutional. Because, and more compellingly, because this the common law right to claim has been taken away. I hope that satisfies your question.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I hope I can still remember all the questions, but I will try. If I fail, please remind me.
Okay.
In terms of the prescribed tariff, I'm not arguing for or against the prescribed tariff. In fact, when the medical profession tried to have tariffs agreed in itself, that was turned over by the Competition Commission, who said that whatever tariff the medical practitioners agree on, then is collusion and anti-competitive behaviour. So the medical association was used annually to publish recommended tariffs for doctors, and they could choose what they, but they were, it was prevented from publishing further recommendations in that regard. So the medical fraternity is in disarray because nobody knows what to charge. And the idea of the Competition Commission is just charge what you like or what you can get away with or what competitive behavior in the marketplace dictates. I don't think that's good. If a tariff, however, is to be prescribed, it must be a realistic tariff. And by realistic, I mean that a person who can get benefits at that tariff does actually have access to those benefits. Now, as an example of that, there is one of the prescribed tariffs in South Africa for medical services is the Compensation Commission of the Compensation of Occupational Injuries and Diseases, COIDO. That tariff, and I've referred to this in my submission to the Constitutional Court in 2010, that tariff is a lot higher than the tariffs that at that stage were proposed by the Minister of Transport. But I know, all practicing doctors know, that there are some doctors who will agree to work for that tariff, and many don't agree. Now, in fact, what is interesting is that the real reason that doctors often refuse to treat COIDO patients on their tariff is not because of the level of the tariff, but because the commissioner just doesn't pay. So years can go by and you send accounts, but you just don't get paid. So for any system of services to be realistic, the level has to be such that people who are able to deliver that service are willing to deliver it at that level, and also that they must get paid. So whether it's left or right, I don't have any preference. But I'm just saying that if the purpose of the Act is to give people access to medical treatment, it must be able to achieve that objective. The questions about recommendations about what should be done in terms of people who are not knowledgeable about their health condition or their circumstances, how to access benefits or health treatment, that is exactly what has been dealt with in the report that I referred to earlier. So by going through that report, one will see how that assists people and doctors to have knowledge and to be able to be referred to places where they need to be referred to. I don't know whether the question about abolishing, improving or maintaining the RAT was directed at me, but I think in a certain sense it was. I am very well aware of shortcomings in the Road Accident Fund Amendment Act, as it is. But whether it is better to take it as it is, take away its problems and fix the problems, so to use that as a basis for improvement, or whether it's better to scrap it completely and write a whole new act, I don't think is in my competence. But I do think that one of those two things must happen. But it is wrong, it is just morally wrong, to take a thing that has got some functionality, but many problems, and then replace it with a thing that's worse. Because if we replace it with RADS as it is now, it will be taking a bad thing and replacing it with a worse thing. And I fully agree, and I'm very much encouraged by the sentiment I've heard from various members of this portfolio committee today. The social obligation to make good law, and to make law particularly that is good for poor people. Yes.
Honourable Ramachaka.
No, thank you very much, Honourable Chair, and thank you very much for the presentation. I think that there's a lots of information that one will obviously have to work through and consider that has been presented by the team. So I think that going back to where we started, that our intention is to have to come out here with the good law. Certainly, RAW as it stands has to be changed, and this is the process. So I think let's make that point so that there is no misunderstanding that there is going to be a reversal of the process. The process is that we all have to work together to come out with the best product. I think if you take that as a spirit, then you don't have to defend anything. I don't have to have an impression that you're defending anything. You must have the impression that I'm pushing through anything irrespective. I think for me, that's probably what I need to say as a concept. That I think for me, many things that have been said, but perhaps let me just zoom into this. And thank you very much, Doctor, for your passion in terms of explanation. Because we are learning also through those kind of presentations of practical case study of what has happened. Advocate the concerns that you raise, I think, in terms of going forward. I think with your legal brain and the input must be towards helping us fixing what is wrong with what you see in the proposed bill. I don't think the approach of the, which I hesitate to say this, but let me say it. I don't think that the intention here is to disadvantage the child. No, I don't think it is it's best to because I think the kind of emphasis of the argument around the emotional aspect of the child. I think it's a very different. I'm a bit uncomfortable with that. It's a persuasive argument. Because I find it to be quite of a strong persuasive argument to use that to remain with the status quo. So that's why I started by saying I don't think the status quo that we're maintaining. Let's work together to finding something that is good for South Africa, that is also going to be a recurring program. We know that the fees, part of legal fees, continuously to spiral out of the fees of those who represent those that are unable to represent themselves. If one looks at 2015-16, you'd see that the legal costs went up by 42%. But as the percentage of the claimants has gone up only by mere 25%, that situation is unsustainable. The argument that you're making about the child, the well-being, the futuristic, basically get debunked. Because if your fee goes up by 42% and the fee of a claimant by mere 25%, there's a problem which you, as has a legal paternity that due to the adult children and the society must acknowledge. And then say, while we are arguing this way, let's then, what is the equilibrium? How do we move from this to that point? Because I don't want to get an impression that the strong argument is self-interest. I don't want that. The fairness and justice can't be excused. Can't make that happen. But let me leave that point there. I just want to make that statement so that at least let's clear the air. So at least we have kind of information. You have information. I think we can meet some with your legal friends. And I do want to make an appeal to legal friends, advocate, son. I like that question, but let's direct it to finding a solution in this context of doing a good law. The doctor, you end up, of course, the advocate makes this point of the fact that the procedural aspect, section chapter 7, and the people will not be able to interpret or actually understand what it means because of the conditions. Why can't that be, if we were to improve that section, can that be a function that it is, can that be a function that is crafted so that the state, remember the state has a responsibility in terms of what we're talking about. Can there be a particular crafting that puts the responsibility also on the public, I'm talking about state, I'm talking about those who works in that section, that some of the requisite skills that they may have to get to be able to help, because this must be a function that does not necessarily, at the end, is performed for profit. The social responsibility. So why must it only be a function that is performed by private legal fraternity? Why can't it be that we have something in there, and I'm sure you can help us to get to that point, but I'm not sure whether you'll be having lots of energy, because that means less income if that functional area becomes a function that is posed onto private public sector. That means the department, not even the department, the agency that has this functional area has to make sure that it has the requisite skills to be able to help and protect those that are vulnerable. So I'm asking this question. Why can't we think out of the box rather than, because the intention here is to make the scheme cheap, affordable, without necessarily saying they're shortchanging the claimants or those who are vulnerable. I mean, 8 billion something went to legal fraternity in the previous financial year for legal and all that. And I like the mediation as a form of a dispute. Maybe we'll read into the NGO report, because that begins to cut down the cost. So I think let's look at that and see. So I'm saying extending it from that argument, we can also make a provision that put a responsibility on the people who are functionally, administratively, to make sure that they come to a defense of those who are vulnerable in the course of the accident. Without necessarily. So that's the first question I wanted to ask. If we were to build that mechanism, what would that mechanism look like in with your experience around some of these? Then the issue about the tariffs, I think, I don't think we have a big issue with the kind of the tariffs and the reasonability of that in terms of it. I think the only problem is what you're saying is that you are not allowed to have a agreement, because at the end the interpretation that it said there's a collusion, but there was some collusion. Right? So fixing that collusion with something or nothing is also some challenge in it. So somehow I think the practitioners could come to some degree of understanding what the working guidelines around that, because it can't just be that it's just open. I like the whole thing about the access to care issue. It's a pin, and I think maybe it is worth saying that we will look at it as we look at the document in full. Let me end by saying, Chair, there was the issue about the 25 and 24 claims. But I guess, maybe let me ask as a question, advocate. Common law, right? Why is it argument that by putting an act would necessarily repeal the common law, right? This is established. A common law right exists. So why arguing that if RAF makes certain proposal equals completely outlawing common rights? I don't understand it. I'm not a lawyer. But I just want you to help me to understand it. Surely that can't be the case. I don't think there was ever intention that this is one area of repealing, of outlawing, of making sure that this act becomes alpha and omega on the issue of the common law right. Because it's a well-established legal principle that it says there's a lot of case law about it. So why is it an issue, if you were to explain to me, not understanding the law and so on, and maybe that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Our rights, or Bill of Rights, contain certain provisions that are sacrosanct. We know what we've gone through in the past. And it's a bit of an emotional sort of topic where people had been sentenced to life, to death in prison. Pre-94. Therefore, we have the inalienable right to live, and we cannot be sentenced to death. That's just a starting point, how, and obviously the preamble of our constitution makes it clear to what extent we have striven for these rights, how sacrosanct these rights are, and I made these particular submissions in this case also with regard to the child's right in the common matter, where I made the point that the child is not prejudiced because the foster parent or the foster care had been, that particular grant had been forthcoming, and therefore that right of the child to the support had not been invaded or evaded. But the Constitutional Court said in that judgment there are two different rights. You've got to accept that, you've got to concede that. Not really consider that, it is. Coming to the current bill as it stands here, there are two issues that concerns me. The one is the scrapping of the right or the compensation for general damages. And I've already highlighted, excuse me, the constitutional provision of being, having a peace loving society, free from violence, etc., etc. Now we know by analogy, and I do also a lot of work for the police and the Ministry of Police, where people are, and I'm just giving an analogy here, honourable members, just for, as a background, where young children, and the Buddha judgment made it quite clear in the Western Cape High Court, where a child was placed in the cell with other children, but bigger children, physically bigger children, and he was raped, and painfully, this particular provision becomes apt to be free from violence, and the ministry had to fork out 1.3 million rand. There's the right to dignity, the right to be equal, the right to be free from violence. Now, obviously the question then is a second inquiry, it would be general damages and the right to, once educated, to strive for education, for a better life for all, a better life for that particular family. And that very right is being taken away when a Glasgow coma sunk to 4 out of 15, rising from a motor vehicle collision, virtually brain damage. Now you recover and you cannot claim for future loss of income, common law right. Now, if the rights... No, sorry, I interrupted there, my apology. The certain rights in the Bill of Rights are, of course, limited. And the limitation is to be found in Section 36 of our Constitution. And to these limitations of the rights, the courts then look at what is best, whether that limitation is reasonable and justifiable in our open and democratic society, which we all strive for, premised on dignity, equality and freedom. Then comes the point, what factors are to be taken into account, inter alia, the nature of the right, the importance of the purpose of the limitation, the nature and extent of the limitation, relationship between the limitation and its purpose, less restrictive means to achieve the purpose. Now, one, it seems to me, and that is apparent, in terms of Section 28, no civil action for damages in respect of bodily injury or death of any person caused by or arising from a road accident shall lie against the owner or driver. Section 28A and B. In other words, the common law right is excluded. And therefore, the emphasis by the previous speaker and the speaker on my right hand side that particular common law right is seriously made inroad to claim A, because of the driver or the owner will allow the driver to drive with a flat tire, with a complete rimless tire, therefore there's no right. that's the painful issue in this matter, that one doesn't have the right to claim against him. That's in terms of the act. And given Section 36, I'm not sure whether government will be able to put up a case to bring into line 36(1)(a) to E, especially when that right has been eroded to general damages and, of course, the loss of income capacity. Therefore, the plea previously and my previous members to reconsider that, perhaps for the balance to go against the driver and or owner, that might encourage people to take on insurance. And I don't have the answer as yet to what extent how we can address, but perhaps we should look at this particular issue, relook at it, put our heads together, and as you correctly pointed out, let's have a practical solution to this, where we can all live together under that particular act. I hope that satisfies.
It's quite useful. I think quite interesting, advocate. I think that's quite a useful approach. That I mean, earlier I asked the Legal Resource Center, were they thinking about kind of third party insurance and payment on some of the things that came. So they didn't, they said they will think about it. And I think you were here when they spoke. Maybe it's useful that you also think about it, that you're saying this. But advocate, with respect to the first question that you addressed, and that deals with the common law and the rights, and it is not the intention of the, even if it was going to be the intention of the lawmakers to make the law that is in conflict with the Constitution. So what is in the Constitution is protected, all of us agree in terms of those. There's no intention at all of the, I don't even think the it crosses our mind, because immediately you can't, the Constitution is a supreme law. So the section that you refer to, that you read, can never be changed by law. So let's agree on that. So if anything is written in law, is technically repealed, because there's no law that will ever replace the Constitution or provision. So that concept, I think let's just agree on it, that there's never going to be intention of lawmakers to make a law that seems to bystanders come behind the back door to try and amend the conferred right in the Constitution. Yeah, we will never do it. It's unthinkable of us to do it, if there was anything like that. So if we agree on that, so whatever you made a reference to clause 28 or section 28 in terms of the concern that you have raised, we will look at that in the context of this discussion. So if you proceed from that understanding, therefore, am I correct to make this assumption that it seems like issues have been narrowed? There's a huge, we have narrowed the issue of almost what things that you can say we don't agree on. We've narrowed them to zero. Because we now say, let's relook at the, put our heads together on this particular wiring part, and if we come up with an agreement that we already said, we look like we were persuaded with the mediation. Mediation as a form, which I think the intention of trying to lower down the, not only resolving issues through litigation, was gravitating towards this mediation, even though it was not said in that language of mediation. So if we agree on that, for me, it looks like the issues that we have narrowed lots of issues that we, when we started, we almost looked like we were far apart in them. doctor, I still want to hear you from the
any
questions,
please. Thank you, Honorable Matlakari. You see, I can't say your name. On the issue of legal representation, I'm talking to that issue not as a lawyer, because I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not talking as an actuary or an economist or anything. I'm talking from my perspective of the necessity for people to have legal representation. That I believe is an important right of people. And And where I particularly come even-handedly into that arena is when I function as a mediator. Because I see a powerful party, which is the state, and a poor and vulnerable person, and they are in conflict. It is necessary to have it fair and to have it level, that at least they must be able to have somebody advising them of their rights. Now, when I say that, it may sound as if I am promoting the interests of legal practitioners. That is not why I'm saying it. I'm saying it because people need that. But other things that I've said may be seen to be against the rights or the interests of legal practitioners. Because, for example, the proposals and the recommendations and the motivation that I have made for mediation as opposed to litigation have been opposed by lawyers because they will make less money from a case that resolves in 2 months through mediation than 7 years in the court. Now, it's not that a lawyer should charge less money because he's representing somebody in mediation. A professional fee should be a professional fee, whatever is a reasonable professional fee, and it's either an hourly rate or a daily rate. That is reasonable in the professions work. But if a lawyer is representing his client and that matter can be resolved speedily with few letters and few arguments and few fees ringing up all the time, he will earn less. But of course, because it goes and he earns less from this case, he also has less risk and less disbursements. He doesn't have to pay many experts and pay for many investigations because it goes to bed quickly. And I believe that there's enough conflict in this country for all lawyers to have enough work to put food on their tables. I cannot see that any law that affects road accident victims can make paupers out of lawyers. I don't believe that. So, now, turning to whether they must be paid or do it as a public service, you alluded to, let us say, NGOs. Now, there are angels in our society, like the people who were here this morning. They out of their bleeding hearts, help vulnerable people, in their case, asylum seekers and refugees. They don't do it for a profit incentive. They do it because they want to help. Now, what I'm saying has got nothing to do whether that function should be performed by angels or by people wanting to make money. That's not my issue. And to whatever extent there are NGOs who, on the one hand, have the capacity and are able to assist people in that regard, and to charge little or no fees for it, obviously that would serve equally well the rights of the injured person. Of course, again, you are inviting me outside my field, but into the field of economy, I don't know how many such people there are in the country. And you will also recall that there are two separate types of function. The one is more administrative and the other one is legal. So the administrative thing is simply filling in the form, submitting the claim to the proper place and in the proper time and in the proper manner. That is now currently done by attorneys. I don't know whether somebody who's not an attorney but has got that administrative capacity would be able to do that. Because that to me is not really a legal issue, it's not a conflict issue. It's an administrative function. But then, when an offer is made which is not a reasonable offer, that to me becomes a legal issue. And an administrative person, I believe, would not be able to make a fair determination of whether this person should or should not accept that offer. And I would like to illustrate that with history, because I've been around the block many times. And for example, I've been in matters where attorneys have been sued for undersettlement of claims. And what has been shocking to me in those instances is how far the undersettlement has been. again, my area is brain injuries. So I, for example, been in matters where 10 years after the event, it goes to court and the court determines that this claim is 5 million rand. And it was settled for 40,000 rand 8 years ago. Now, the attorney and the fund, who were party to that undersettlement, were clearly not right. Now, one has to be very careful if whoever is structured into doing the administration works for the administrator, because then their direction will be to make it as cheap as possible for the administrator. Whereas the actual purpose for social justice should be that the people who are assisting or representing injured people, where their purpose must be the legitimate rights of the injured person. So I don't have a solution for you, but those are my considerations. And I do like your concept about NGOs participating in the process. I've given you a few thoughts about that. What I would like to say about mediation, the report that I will provide to you was signed in March 2016. In that report, I made reference to the role of mediation for road accident fund matters. But in March 2016, I had very much less experience in mediation than I have today. And since that time, not only have I been involved in mediation, I've been involved in promotion and discussion and debates. I've also written, together with Judge Klaassen, a document called Guidelines for Medical Mediation and Protocol for Medical Mediation. And we have also written a proposal for the Gauteng MEC for Health to do what we call a pilot project of medical mediation for, in that case, negligence claims against the Provincial Health Department. And we've already also communicated this to the Minister of Health. So I am now in a better position to speak more particularly to the method of implementation of medical mediation, if the committee is interested in pursuing that avenue.
Thank you. Honourable Sibande.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want also to join my colleague and thank you very much to come to give us this presentation. But nevertheless, somewhere we ask some clarities. Chairperson, mine, I wanted to comment first. You see, Chairperson, since we started this morning, I think you are among of the best people to start, maybe to go to the Navy. Unlike the previous presenters, from my side, what I've observed is that some of their focal point was on social welfare. I won't mention which one. Most of the issues was from social welfare. And the second one was from home affairs. If you talk about refugees and immigration, whatever, most of those things, they fall in the categories of home affairs, while we are dealing with transport here. Then let me come to another comment. See, in South Africa, it's very dynamic. Most of these legal people, instead of joining the work on and helping us to find a solution, they disappear, they distance themselves. But at the end, it's very easy for them to challenge the government or the ruling party in the constitutional court. That's what is happening. At the moment, we open our hands that come and help us in order to have an amicable solution to solve the problem. That's what we are requesting in terms of your presence here. And then nevertheless, I'll go to tariffs. You see, with tariffs, you are right about this thing of medical competition. But let me cite an example. There was an incident, I'll repeat again, in 2002, here in Stellenbosch. A guy from Switzerland. His name is Joachim Scott. was involved in an accident with a motorbike, head-on collision with Mr. this guy, Vuyisile Nana, Muzuvukile Benton Nana, was driving the car. So, after that incident, this guy, Scotch, left the country. And he was demanding money in dollars. He was blaming South African government, I mean, too rough. 4.5 billion rand. Guess what? How much was he paid? He was paid 500 million rand. Tell me in your calculation. Any incident, including these photos which were presented to us, who was paid that amount? So there is a great discrepancy. But it's easier for some people, they provoke that maybe this scheme must be vulnerable to the people who are wanted maybe to get money in that way. I don't think that is correct. If you are concerned about kids so much, I must listen to you deeply. So, concern the example of the kids, what. But let's prioritize. Excuse me, first, let's put our country first. And also, here is the question. Help us with things which you feel that are unconstitutional without going to constitutional court. In which sense, I'll put an example from the RAF side. With the amendment, RAF Amendment Act number 19 of 2005, there were two issues which was removed, which was removed, the claims for general damage for minor injuries, and then also removed for the residual common law claim. Those issues, the court found that it was lawful. So what other methods you feel that can assist in this regard? Because our intention, I repeat again, is to have an amicable solution. And like, you know, other people, their intention is to make sure that the status quo remains as it is. I'll put an example. I didn't want you to bring an argument early in the morning when a person is arguing about sexual commission. Because we can discuss a lot of things about the findings and some of the things which the people perceived, whereby it is alleged that there is a group of lawyers and doctors who wanted to be a contract with the RAF forever. What kind of contract is that one? They wanted to be contracted for, that's why they are defending the RAF. That we mustn't implement the RAF scheme, because once you touch the RFA, their contracts will be damaged forever. First question, who signed this contract? From which year? Because every time and again, after 10 or so, couple years, we revisit some laws and review them. But with them, the status quo must stay as it is. Their own company must stay as it is. I want to repeat again. I indicated to you earlier, or not to you directly, for the some presenters, about the damages that the people who were trying, who were caught frightened to try to steal monies, because the intention of the people, I repeat again, is to try to have a way of stopping some of these people who are taking advantage, instead of feeling the pain for the poor, giving this money to the really relevant people. They wanted to take the money for themselves. For example, how many companies are alleged, loss firms are alleged that they take the money from road accident fund, they put them in their scheme. And then they tell the person, wait up until so much years, instead of giving him, including the profit, they give you that money, the profit stays with them forever. I'm from the township. Some of our families, they even die without getting that money. which they think that they are protecting them. So may you please help us. What are the issues which are not constitutional? And then how to get remedy, to get rid of those people who think that they wanted to pay pounds and dollars. Thank you.
You can respond.
Thank you. I know of the person, the Swiss matter, and I can tell you about Edem with you when you condemn that we had to pay out so much of money, taxpayers' money. You and I contribute, we all contribute to that getting. But that cannot be. It will never happen again. Because that matter, if I recall correctly, was the pre-08 matter, pre-capping matter. So I can, with an open heart and a very vivid heart, tell you, we will never pay out again dollars and millions of dollars for such a claim. And this is one lurking storm that I'm not aware of. But after 1st May 2008, all these claims are capped. I've made mention earlier about a German claim which is already apportioned at 30-70 and it will be capped in terms of the capping. So there won't be German dollars that will leave our offshore. So that, I hope, that sort of answers the question on, and I understand your hurt and understand why we paid so much money. But unfortunately the law was as it was then. It was here then, and we had to pay in terms of the applicable law relevant at the time. The second issue is the theft. I think my colleague earlier had touched on that. But let me elaborate, coming from the criminal courts, where I was involved for many years, especially in the regional and high courts. I recall many prosecutors prosecuting those who stole the client's money. And many attorneys went to jail. And that was heart-serving. And if there's anybody, for that matter, currently still doing that, they must be prosecuted. But I think it's unfair, with the greatest of respect, to the majority of the attorneys who I deal with against and for, who are very, very cautious. They do their bill of account, they account to their client, and very few of these particular funds land up, the capital land up, in as you put it, in the name of theft, from a criminal point of view. And if they are, I can tell you, if you want to give me a private prosecution, I will prosecute that particular attorney. Because that's condemnable, that's not to be found in a civil society, and it's outrageous. The last point that you raised, I don't know whether you want to touch it upon the minor injuries and the new act. Thank you, I hope that, but I can assure you, we're not going to lose another Scots here. We're not going to lose another millions in terms of the capping that's really in process. I've seen it. I've seen how the actuaries have dealt with these matters and the claim has just come down. Some in the range of 70%, some in the range of 60%. So that is what we're doing at the moment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in terms of your comment apropos the Amendment Act of 2005 and the Constitutional Court's finding regarding the lawfulness of the restriction on general damages and the abolition of the common law claim, I think we must be very careful to properly contextualise that. That was in that context of being left with general damages for serious injury, so it's reasonable. It's within the context of a cap, which when carefully analysed, very few matters fell above that cap. in terms of the numbers of claimants affected. So when you consider all of that, it was on that basis that the Constitutional Court found that the abolition of the common law claim in particular was lawful. That is not the situation which we are faced with here, but I don't want to belabor that point. I've made those points earlier. I think that's all the Honourable Sabanda still had outstanding.
Madam Chair, I think there were certain questions directed at me. First of all, I just want to support 100% everything Advocate Sali said. I'm fully with him and fully with you, Honourable Sabanda. The point that I think has not been addressed is the point of long-term contracts of professional people with the Road Accident Fund.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very much against that. In my view, that is unethical. To me, a professional person has got competence. He has got the capacity to find a job for himself. And a professional person works on a daily basis for clients who come to him or her because of their competence, because of their integrity. So to have a long-term cushy job because you signed a contract with somebody, I think is wrong. I don't think that should be allowed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. We, Honourable Sibande, we have already overstepped our time. We need to round up. We're supposed to be out of here by 2:30, if you can look at your chronology.
Justice,
it's an hour now that we have been here. I'm seeing you, Honourable Sibanda, finalise, and I'm giving you 2 minutes to say what you want to say.
Yeah, referring to the RAF which we struck out from court, which we legitimised, I was asking you that if you can help us, maybe even not now, maybe to submit to us some of the issues which you feel that they are unconstitutional. That's what was requested at last. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Khadebe.
Thanks, Chair. No, Chair, I've got just short few questions. My question is in relation to my concern is that most of the NGOs, as you were just elaborating, Doctor, is that NGOs, their main objective or their main establishment is for non-profit operation and. But if you can just do your proper research at the current juncture, I think started after 2010, most of those NGOs, they pretend as if they are non-profit organizations, but in the utmost honest fact, they are making more than what they're supposed to get. Because their own operation, they are sucking out of the state's coffers. That's why some of them may also sue the state in terms of, you know, taking particular responsibilities. But if you can check in terms of their income gain, it's more than what they're supposed to gain. And they are making dividends out of those things. That's what you must be able to be honest about. But I also want to check whether what do you think you know, say in a marketable way to deal with these particular NGOs, because these NGOs, some of them they are supported by certain structures or certain professionals, either professional doctors or professional lawyers outside to gain more money from the state. What do you think we must be able to do or to curb such kind of issues within the RAFs? Probably the other aspect, I needed just to check in terms of your viewing. I heard Robert Lakane when he was asking you I didn't get a real essence in terms of what is the reasonable amount in terms of the remuneration that you think can be able to much give a value. Because I'm asking this in relation to that your reasonable amount may differ from a rural perspective and urban perspective, because we know very well that you know, doctors that are working at the in the urban cities, they charge more than what they expect. What, you know, for an example, if you go around here in town, you go to a doctor will charge you 1,500 rand and give you a prescription that you must go buy medication outside in the pharmacy. But when you go to in the rural areas, you find a doctor that charges 500 rand, also give you a medication at the access. Because I heard that there's also that particular perspective and argument in terms of the medical fraternity that they argue in terms of this. I'm trying to check in terms of this particular perspective of RAPS, what is the reasonable amount in terms of these two categories, urban areas and rural areas, but also similar to the law fraternity as well. I think it's almost fair to say, because you also consider the fact either whether it's rural or urban, how do you also make your reasonable amount of charge extension?
Thank you very much, Honourable Adebe. In terms of the reasonable fee or tariff for medical practitioners, I must profess my ignorance because I'm not an expert on that topic. And whatever I say would be from my limited experience. However, there are organizations who have studied this, who have done market research, and who have got a lot of statistics. So, for example, there's a private company called HealthMan, which has done many studies on the economy and costs of practice of all different kinds of specialities and general practitioners in different areas. They can provide the committee, for example, with actual sensible figures. Also, the Health Professions Council of South Africa has competence in that regard, and you may wish to speak to them. And also you may wish to speak to the Board of Healthcare Funders. So if you understand, Honourable Adebe, my submission here is not on it should be this or it should be that. I'm saying it must be realistic so that the service can actually be accessed. So that is the first thing. On the question of NGOs, it was not my recommendation that NGOs should do the work. I was responding to a suggestion by Honourable Ramatlakane that there are NGOs. And I acknowledge that there are NGOs, and I acknowledge that there are honourable and honest NGOs. But again, I'm not an expert on which NGOs are crooks and which NGOs are angels. I really don't know. And in fact, in my view, the best way to ensure a proper professional service that is necessary for the rights of people, those people who provide the service should be paid a fair and reasonable tariff for the work that they do. So they don't have to go around the corner and steal from the back door because they feel they didn't get enough through the front door.
Honourable Ramatlaka, last, what, 2 minutes?
Yeah, I'm going to be very, very brief. And, Dr. Elia, when you were responding to the legal right issue, do you have a problem? Because you then said administrative function. We must be able to make sure that administrative function is not necessarily blurred with that of the legal function. My actual point was, you have RAF who administer the functions including the payout of the process. And I was saying at the first instance, in terms of their work, in terms of appropriately, they must have the requisite skills to help those that require help, because the legal right is a choice. A choice that must be made by an individual. It's not just a blanket thing, so that those that want to go the route of saying there is a requisite skills or competent skilled person in the current agency must have the first response or responsibility to deal with them, to help them, not only just about the form that we're talking about. The second, the persons always have the right, reserve the right to go and look for legal advice elsewhere. But the first instance, because you want to flatten the cost factor, you build in a mechanism that there must be obligations of that agency to have a requisite skills, and that not only administrative, to help the victims, because it's primarily their responsibility. That was my additional point. Do we have a problem in that? Because almost I'm looking at a situation where that, in any case, a legal rights can never be taken away. It's there all the time. Just to make sure that you have that kind of, that's why I was asking your opinion on that matter.
Thank you, Honorable Rastana. I have one fundamental and very important problem with your suggestion. Clearly, any fund, any administrator would have the capacity to appoint people who are properly trained and properly capable to perform whatever function. The problem is simply independence. When an administrator appoints staff to help people who are claiming money from the administrator, it just can't work. And experience shows that it doesn't work. Because their leaning, their bias, as you said, will be to pay less. That is the problem. So the issue is that to assist the member of the public properly, the assister must be independent from the payer. Well, the way that members of the public now access that legal right to independent representation is by being able to employ lawyers on a contingency fee basis. That is their only access to that right. And if any law is to take away that mechanism, it should be replaced by another but independent mechanism.
Sorry, Madam Chair, can I just supplement that last answer, specifically relating to legal advice, and I support what Dr. Edling says in terms of it has to be independent. An interesting feature which hasn't been addressed yet of the RABS bill is that there's an express exclusion of liability on their part or any part of any of the officials for any wrongdoing on their part which causes harm to a claimant, unless that wrongdoing is intentional, which we can agree is never going to be established or is going to be established with great difficulty. And what I just want to remind the committee as well is that where a victim is represented by an attorney, if there's wrongdoing on the part of an attorney, we get sued and we're insured for that. So the victim is not left in the cold. That's all I wanted to supplement on that.
Honourable members, it looks like we are done for today. We still have plenaries that are going on. Let me thank everybody who presented. I can still see delegation from the Law Society of South Africa still here. Thank you very much. The other team is gone, and the other team is gone anyway. The other two teams are not here, partially. But I want to thank you for the insightful information that you have been able to give to us. Doctor, I would really appreciate if you can submit the document that you're talking to, so that members can be able to have an opportunity to go into it. But if there's any other thing, as we will be dealing with your presentations and having discussions that we believe you should be able to come further elaborate, we will do so. We'll give you, you'll get information that we'd want you to come and talk to certain aspects of your presentation. On that note, let me thank everybody who is here. And tomorrow we will take a partial break. We'll start again on Tuesday because we are preparing for our budget debate on Friday. So we're giving members ample time to can be able to go and prepare for the budget debate of the Department of Transport. The meeting is adjourned until next week, Tuesday. Thanks. Thank you once more, everybody. All in Sunday.
Tom, I really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Next time we'll remember.
Yeah.
It was, oh, okay. Oh, shit.